Welcome to the CB Wallet Podcast. I'm Phil Lucas.
And I'm Phil Gerrard. Why are we here, Phil?
Well, we are going to talk about the greatest disasters in world history and some that you probably never heard of. What went wrong, how it went wrong, and whether it was our fault or God in the sky's fault.
Bloody marvellous. But remember, Phil, not our intention to make light of the sometimes quite substantial mortality rates in some of these disasters, is it, Phil?
Nope.
Right, we're just interested in finding out what went wrong. And be honest with yourself, Phil, if it came on the news, I reckon you'd be interested, you frickin' sociopath.
I'm always revved up for a big breaking news story, Phil. Sky News is my drug of choice.
What are we wanging on about this week?
The Le Mans disaster.
When the greatest sports car event of the year, the Le Mans 24-hour race, opens in brilliant sunshine, none of the 250,000 crowd suspect the tragedy that lies ahead. All seems to be going smoothly when disaster strikes at 125 miles an hour. LeVay's Mercedes collides and blows up. Ghastly seconds, death wipes out whole families. LeVay is killed before his wife's eyes and some 70 spectators with him.
Motor racing is boring. It's boring, isn't it? And it's occurred to me that it's maybe stories like this which is why motor racing is now quite so boring, right? Because in the 50s, it was really exciting.
Oh, yeah. What you're saying is when there was a high chance of death at any race, it had a certain je ne sais quoi.
I mean... You a fan of motor racing?
Years ago, when I used to work for Honda, I was quite a fan. I hate extreme sports.
Yeah.
Motor racing is an extreme sport, but it's an extreme sport that starts with the letter E, not the letter X in a different font. Therefore, it's not wanky.
Have you ever seen a crash?
Nothing. I've seen cars come off tracks, but not in the period we're talking about. I mean, it is all the time. Jackie Stewart, who was racing in the 70s, he lost virtually all of his friends.
Well, when did they start wearing seatbelts? Like, because in the 50s, they didn't wear seatbelts, did they?
No, and rarely helmets.
I mean, that's just... Can they not see that that's insanity?
Stronger men, better men.
Well, I mean, are they stronger than a wall approaching you at 150 miles an hour? It's insane. I read that it's because they thought it was much safer to be thrown clear.
Yeah. I don't know whether experience has proven that not to be the case.
I like the idea that you have to go go-karting before you're allowed to go into Formula One, because there's nothing else that starts that way, is there? If you want to get into the Marines, you have to start with Laser Quest.
They all start go-karting. Yeah. Your top, you know, you think of the most famous motor racing drivers you could think of off the top of your head.
Yeah.
Alain Prost, Ayrton Senna, Michael Schumacher, Lewis Hamilton.
Yeah.
They've all started
the go-karting. And before that, of course, Mario Kart.
Go-karting annoys me.
Why is that?
I've done it a couple of times. It's good fun just going around the circuit. You always get some wanker who thinks he's Jenson Button. And just wants to cut you up, show he's better. I'm just enjoying this. I'm not trying to beat you.
Fucking bumper cars. Bumper cars, the idea of bumper cars is the bumping, right? Mm. Every fairground, you'll have one weekend dad thinking he's Lewis Hamilton around that bumper car track. One hand on the wheel, one on the other seat, on his own as well, not with the kids. The kid's in his own car, right? And he's going round the outside instead of going through the middle and bumping into people. Round the outside like a fucking winner. Well done, mate. You won bumper cars. Right, so, Phil, the 1955 Le Mans disaster. What was it?
It was a crash at the Le Mans 24-hour race that caused large fragments of debris to fly into the crowd.
When did it happen?
The 11th of June, 1955.
And how many people died?
It's about 84. But it could have been more. All but one of the dead were spectators. The other person was a driver. It is still the deadliest motor racing disaster of all time.
For people like me who don't know anything about motor racing because it's boring, what was Les Mans?
Les Mans is a city in France. Right?
It's a place.
Le Mans, it's a place. If France, Phil, were a clock face, it would be at about 10 o'clock.
Oh, okay.
Right. But about a third of the way down... The small hand.
Okay.
Yeah.
So sort of in the middle.
It is 209 kilometres driving from Paris if you're going in a southwesterly direction.
Okay.
If you shot your car north, it's about 425 kilometres to Calais.
Lovely.
France is quite big, isn't it?
Massive, yeah. Big, round thing, France. Been to France?
Yeah, many times.
Everyone's been to France, haven't they? It's one of those places that you go so many times, it doesn't really feel like abroad anymore. Mm. Although, end of October, it may as well be on the fucking moon for us. Because we're closing the borders, isn't it? So they have a big race there in Les Mains.
Yes.
Tell me about the race.
Okay, well, I'm going to go straight to Wikipedia for this one. The 24-hour Le Mans race, or in French, 24 Heures de Mans, is the
very,
world's...
Very nice. Thanks Can I just stop you there? Very nice.
It is the world's oldest active sports car race in endurance racing,
right.
Held annually since 1923 near the town of Le Mans in France. It is considered one of the most prestigious automobile races in the world and has been called the Grand Prix of Endurance and Efficiency. The race awards a win to the car that covers the greatest distance in 24 hours.
So the car wins, not the bloke.
And they give it his champagne, he goes...
Thank you very much.
It started off that impression as a horse, then realised I'd meant to be doing a car.
If the car breaks down halfway, do they shoot it in the tyres? I bet they do, the rich fucks.
Right, to make that clear, Phil, I'm now off Wikipedia.
Okay.
So this isn't just like one car, one driver.
Right.
They got to drive for 24 hours.
Yeah.
So that's one car, two drivers.
Yeah.
Right? One person really couldn't drive for 24 hours, or certainly shouldn't.
And they're not the cars that are sort of like Formula One cars, are they?
No, look, not four big wheels at the end.
No. And it's not like drag racing, where it's all over in a second. It's very much, you get in a car and you're driving all day. Very boring. I mean, tedious. Especially now, it still happens, right? They don't televise it anymore, do they?
I think it's televised on the
Eurosport.
Yeah, that sort of thing. But yeah, no, it goes on every year.
Really? Because I haven't heard anything about it for years.
Because nobody cares.
Because it's boring. Fundamentally boring.
I used to like motor racing.
Used
but
to.
I still wasn't as keen on those cars.
Oh yeah,
I like cars that look like racing cars.
Yeah, exactly, that's what you want. And you want it to be quick as well. Optimum amount of time for driving, 30 seconds. Tell me about the track, Phil, immediately.
It's held on a mixture of proper normal roads and dedicated racetrack. So it's kind of unusual in that sense. And as a circuit, it's the biggest racing track in the world.
So it would be like you sort of went up the M1 and then turned off onto Silverstone, went round Silverstone and went down the M1.
Yeah.
Something like that.
And yet the weird thing, I don't know if it's the case now, but I did watch a video of someone taking you round the Le Mans track in the mid-50s. And even the track section just had little lorries tonking along and people
really?
On bikes. So I don't know whether it still is, but even that track, the purpose-built track section, was also a public road when it wasn't being
that
used.
That is complete madness.
If you get a chance to watch it, right, listeners and Phil Gerrard,
hello,
watch on YouTube, 1956, Mike Hawthorne, we'll be coming on to him, takes you round the Le Mans track, and he is hammering this car around, but he's talking to you whilst he's doing it.
I've got to be a little careful today because quite a lot of traffic on the road. Accelerating up to Terre Rouge. There's somebody in the way. Don't mind. Cyclists everywhere. Typical French. We're on Moulsan Strait now. Going down here. In the race, we get up to about 175 to 185 miles per hour.
The cars at this time were hitting around 170 miles an hour, right?
Oh, okay.
Nowadays, cars can cover in that 24-hour period on that mixture of normal road and track, they can cover about 3,110 miles.
Right.
That is the equivalent as driving from London to just shy of Baghdad in a day.
That's mental. So that is across America, right? That's essentially across America.
Yeah, in 24 hours.
In 24 hours.
These are very, very fast cars.
Wow. Jesus Christ.
On largely quite tiny roads.
And it is only two of them doing it as well.
Only two of them, yeah.
Okay, lovely. So it's a long way they drove. They drive essentially for 24 hours, very fast, from here to Baghdad.
Exactly.
Except they keep it all in Les Mains.
All in Les Mains, round and round and round.
It is a fabulously dangerous race, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, you're driving for 24 hours round little country roads, avoiding Frenchmen.
Mm.
It sounds like a freaking death trap is what it sounds like. How many drivers have been killed since Les Mains started in 1923?
21, Phil.
That's too many men to have been died in Les Mans.
22, if you include a poor chap who died in a car crash on his way there. That's a bit unfair.
One of the reasons not to do an extreme sport is because you do very much open yourself up to an ironic death. Isn't it?
Yes.
If you are a mountain climber, you are getting killed up a ladder. If you're a racing driver, you're going to get killed on a country road on holiday in Cornwall. That's what's going to happen to you. Bruce Lee died from eating paracetamol.
Did he?
All I'm saying. Right? Don't open yourself up to an ironic death.
22 men over the history of the Le Mans period.
Yeah.
0.21 men a year, that is.
0.21 men a year.
Mm. It's about one man every 5 years if you want to do it in actual whole men terms.
Is that enough men to make it not be something you should do?
Less than I was expecting, actually.
That is less men than I was expecting.
Yeah, but I bet all of them were in the period between 1923 and about 1970.
It's like when they do murder statistics and they go, oh my God, murder rates have gone through the roof. And you go, no, that's just Harold Shipman. That's just one guy. It's like when, if you live in a village, I grew up in a village, and every now and again, what will happen is the crime rate in your village will disappear. And it's because they've arrested one dude. And you go, oh, it was Terry. Terry was responsible for all crime in Boddington. yes, that's not as many men as I thought.
No, it's too many.
It is too many
men. But I was surprised.
It's about the amount of men who die at Glastonbury.
I would cling to anything to use a commentary. I would like to prorogue Glastonbury.
We definitely need to prorogue that festival. Get it prorogued.
Actually, that would make quite an interesting graph, the number of deaths at Le Mans compared to the number of deaths at Glastonbury. I actually think Glastonbury, you're right, would be more.
Probably more.
Would be more. Phil,
yeah.
This 1995 Le Mans race we're going to talk about,
oh, yeah.
It is just another of the annual Le Mans races, isn't it? It's nothing particularly sort of special about this one, is there, before we get into what actually happened?
No, this 1955 Les Mans started like any other. It's a huge event in the racing calendar, so I'm told, mainly because they like getting pissed and that, isn't it? Is it like Cannes for films?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's the really wanky one.
I think it's one of those things on the worldwide social calendar.
Yeah.
You know, you've got these sort of rich, posh people have social calendars, and it's Ascot and Wimbledon and
yeah, like for comedians, it's Edinburgh.
Cowdrey Park.
But no, nothing special about this Les Mans. All the big teams are there, as you'd expect. Ferrari's there, Aston Martin's there, Mercedes-Benz, Jaguar, loads of others, all of the big cars.
Yeah, always wanted a Jag.
They want to show that they exist, so they'll go to Les Mans, right?
You're right, Phil. As a marketing tool, it was very good for them. You could win them on, and that could sell you a shed load of your own cars the following week.
One of the teams we need to focus on here, though, is Mercedes-Benz. Germans. Remember them, Phil? Remember the Germans?
I've heard of them.
1955, this is.
Oh, so, 10 years after the war.
10 years after the war. Which war?
The second. the second war to end all wars.
Yeah, that's right. Very rare for a sequel to be better than the original. Mm. The Germans were there, Phil, and they had cars made of Mercedes-Benz. Right. Their car for Les Mans was the Mercedes-Benz 300 SLR. Sounds like a camera.
I have looked that car up on Google, Phil.
Really?
It is a nifty-looking piece of machinery.
It's not the one with the fin, is it? Oh, it's the one with the... It's got a weird...
It's got an air brake.
It's got an air brake.
Yeah.
Which looks like they've just accidentally opened the boot.
Yeah. Now, if you know...
Shit, we have opened the boot!
It does a lot. Yeah, they went around corners and they sort of opened the boot.
Yeah, we went around corners and opened the boot.
But I have looked, it is a beautiful looking car. If you're not remotely into cars, think of that kind of like that little car that James Dean died in.
It was
a Porsche, I think, wasn't it?
Oh, okay.
But, you know, they kind of look like
it's
that.
It's sort
in
of
those
a
era.
Flat bonnet, but rounded where the headlights go.
They look like that.
Very pretty.
Mm.
Okay. In fact, Stirling Moss.
The racing driver with the surname that describes small flowerless plants.
Moss. Stirling Moss is a famous man, isn't he?
Yes.
I've heard of him. Mm. He's mainly famous for driving very fast.
Yes.
I take it. Okay, fine.
Before any of us were born.
Oh, has he been dead a long time?
No, he was just driving before any of us were born. I think he's still alive. He seems to crop up on anything, never seems to age.
People who were born at this time don't tend to die. So Stirling Moss, the immortal Stirling Moss, called the Mercedes-Benz 300 SLR the greatest sports racing car ever built. Really, an unbelievable machine.
He has obviously never driven a 1992 Fiat Uno Turbo like I have.
So, Phil, picture the scene.
Right, yes, sorry.
June 11th, 1955.
Do you want to know what was number one in the charts on June 11th, 1955?
Don't see why not.
Okay, it was Eddie Calvert with Cherry Pink and Apple Blossom. So you got this big race.
Right.
You got all these cars. 60 were running that day. 27 of those were from British manufacturers. The good old days, God bless the Queen. All these drivers, you got all these spectators and all of these drivers' wives and girlfriends watching.
Right.
Actually, Phil, cut the music. I've really had quite enough of that.
Fair enough.
At this race, you've got one big rivalry going on.
Right.
British Jaguar.
Hello, boys.
God save the Queen. And German Mercedes, the Hun.
We used to own this place! And what? Now it is over! We just have to drive around it very fast!
But, British Jaguar.
Yeah.
German Mercedes.
Hello?
What does that make it?
World War II on the tracks!
Yeah.
That's literally what they called it, was it? World War II on
World
the track.
World War II on the track.
I can see that that's what it is, because they're the two. Are they the two biggest cars?
Yeah, there's lots of cars, but these are the major rivalry is Jaguar and Mercedes.
And it's a bit of a saucy upstart story as well, isn't it? Because Mercedes is a great big company, whereas Jaguar is what, like two guys in Clapham or something in a garage. Like, there's not many people who work for Jaguar at this point, right?
Yeah, it was quite a small operation, wasn't it? Yeah, it was sort of very much a garage, whereas Mercedes, as you would expect, hundreds of highly technically skilled...
I mean, they're making planes, right, Mercedes? Yeah. So you'd expect them to win, to be fair. Mm. So it's a big rivalry thing.
Mm.
And Jaguar got a lot to prove.
Yes.
Haven't they? Mm. And they know that if they can win it, they're going to sell an awful lot of fucking Jaguars, mate. Mm. And stick it to Fritz.
So, the Mercedes team had three cars racing at Le Mans. In one of them was legendary driver Juan Fangio.
Juan Fangio.
Have you heard of him?
Nope.
Argentinian chap, probably considered the greatest racing driver of all time. Certainly up to the time that Schumacher won more world championships than him. But he's
really?
A legend, if you know anything about motor racing.
Juan Fangio.
Juan Fangio.
Okay.
In one of the other Mercedes-Benz,
right.
You had a chap called Pierre Levay.
French?
French chap. Now, his actual name was Pierre Boulin.
Oh.
But he raced under the name Levay in memory of his motor racing uncle.
Nice.
Privately, the other drivers called Levay the Bishop.
Oh.
Because he always drove sideways and looked quite solemn. Inevitable gag. No, because he looked quite solemn.
Yeah. Who was in the Jaguar team?
They had a driver called Mike Hawthorne.
And Mike is a big part of this story, isn't he?
A very big part. And for that reason, I watched a documentary about this disaster.
Yeah.
And that disaster documentary called Mike Hawthorne one of the greatest mavericks the sport had ever known. British Pathé called him the gay cavalier of motor racing. he wasn't gay, though. I'll tell you that. He liked the ladies. A lot.
The word maverick, to me, suggests wanker. Like, if somebody said you're eccentric, you'd be like, oh, cool.
Mm.
If somebody said you're an eccentric genius, you'd be like, wow. If somebody called you a maverick, you're like, oh, that guy thinks I'm a bastard. Was he a bit of a bastard?
It's difficult because the more I read about him, the more I liked him.
Yeah, but in a roguish sort of way.
Yeah, I mean, he'd been to public school.
Yeah.
Always drove in a bow tie.
Yes.
I like
which
that.
Which is, I mean, do you?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean,
it's the 50s.
I suppose it's the 50s.
Now, if you did that, I would want to deck you.
Yeah. I mean, if you came in here today and I was wearing a bow tie.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe the first day it might be funny, but then like the third time I wear a bow tie, that starts to get you down.
I would have been, sort yourself out, Phil. Yeah. I'm actually annoyed the operation went so well.
Yeah, exactly. Why couldn't that guy have died of cancer? I prefer cancer than that bow tie.
But, you know, it's the 1950s. He's like, oh, all right, chaps, you know, one of those sort of Terry Thomas type, okay, chaps, been to public school. I'm British. I'll always drive a bow tie whenever I'm racing. Loved a bit of partying. Really went in for a bit of partying. Love life. But to me, that's exactly what you want from a motor racing driver.
That's true, isn't it?
That is a 50s motor racing driver.
There are some... It's like a front man of a band, right? Mm. A front person of a band. You don't want them to be Sharon Retiring. You want them to be Freddie Mercury. You want them to be Liam Gallagher.
Yeah.
You want them to be like hard drinking, hard smoking, womanizing. That's
well, like
what
in
you
the
want.
70s, James Hunt, who's like renowned for drug taking, womanizing, but then going out and whamming it on the track.
Yeah.
On his overalls, he had a sewn badge that said "Sex, the Breakfast of Champions."
That's what you want, isn't it?
That is exactly what you want, Phil. And the Daily Express said of Mike Hawthorne, an exuberant character. He smoked and drank to excess, loved parties and piloted his own plane. But his favourite form of recreation was chasing and seducing Europe's most beautiful women.
Excellent.
I like this man. I like everything about this man. Mind you, you told me a story that made me think, maybe he was a bit of a bellend.
That was also in the Express article, wasn't it? Was it Stirling Moss?
Yeah.
They went to a pub together, and when he went outside, he thought it was raining. When he looked up, it was because Mike Hawthorne was pissing at him out of a tree. He pissed on him. He pissed on Stirling Moss.
If it's not happening to you, you think good old Mike Hawthorne.
I don't know, man. I mean, like, if I'd heard a story that like you pissed on one of my friends, they'd be like, Phil, why did you piss on Steve? He's a nice bloke, Steve. Why'd you? The thing I don't about I think it's weird about Mike Hawthorne pissing on Stirling Moss is the fact that he pissed on him from a tree.
How did he get up the tree without Sterling realising?
What I mean is it can't have been in the moment thing because nobody goes for a piss up a tree. So actually goes to the trouble of climbing a tree. And then he doesn't know that Stirling Moss is coming out of the pub. He's got to wait up a tree with his cock out.
Maybe it's that sort of planning that sets him above us mere mortals. Maybe that's why he's a champion. He's planning,
thinking.
He's
planning, yeah, always planning. Mm. He was living on the edge, Mike Hawthorne, wasn't he? He was like it seemed to me like he was one of those live fast, die young, leave a good-looking corpse type people, right?
Yes, he really was. And he didn't really endear himself to other drivers because of that kind of way of living.
Yeah, they felt he was reckless, I assume.
Yes, yeah. Quite. They did, actually. A lot of drivers thought he was quite reckless. But there was something about Mike Hawthorne that people at the time didn't know. Only his very, very close friends knew.
He had one kidney. Mm. But he had something wrong with his other kidney. So at this point, he thought he only had 3 years to live.
I think he had the sort of diagnosis the doctor said, you're probably going to scrape 30.
Wow.
And that was in 1955.
Yeah.
And he died. We'll come on to
how he died
in 1959 right at the beginning of 1959.
Oh, okay. So this probably would have seen him off. So he's really... you know, he's got nothing to lose, Mike Hawthorne. Mm. And that really comes across in this race, doesn't it? Because people kind of, and we'll talk about who's to blame, people do blame Mike Hawthorne for this, right? And I can see why they do. And one of the reasons is because he's quite reckless and he's driving like there is no future because he probably thinks there kind of isn't a future for him. He may as well just drive as fast as he can, fuck as many people as he can, and piss on as many people as he fancies out of a tree outside a pub.
That's exactly what I'd do.
So he was fully aware of his mortality.
Yeah, and I think that's a very reasonable argument as to why he was the quite sort of reckless maverick that he was. In summary then, after all that bants, you got Mike Hawthorne in his Jag.
Yes.
Juan Fangio in his Merc.
Yeah.
And Frenchman Pierre Levay in another Merc.
Yeah.
They're your main protagonists in this, okay?
Yeah. But the main rivalry is between the Mercedes and the Jaguar.
Yes, and particularly Hawthorne and Fangio.
And particularly Hawthorne and Fangio, because Fangio...
Juan Fangio?
He is like the guy to beat, right? He's the one everyone says is God. Mm. And Mike Hawthorne is like, is he like a plucky upstart?
He's a plucky upstart who was already doing very good things racing.
He's a plucky upstart with one kidney on the verge of death, right? And on top of all of that, you've just had World War II and everyone's got something to prove on the racetrack. That's what this is, right?
World War II on the track.
Yeah. In what was occupied France.
Now, Phil,
yes.
I don't know if you've ever been to a motor race.
I'll stop you right there. Mm. No, I have not.
Okay.
And I shall tell you for why. Terribly boring.
I thought you might say that. Well, I have. So there. And if you are a spectator at a motor race, being near the pits is one of the most desired locations to be because it's all going on there.
Yes.
You're seeing the drivers come out their cars. Yeah. You're seeing the wheels get changed. You're seeing them, the ones that aren't in the pits, still whizzing through. So it's a good place to be. Now, as luck would have it, there was a massive grandstand along the pit straight at Le Mans in 1955. And also next to that grandstand, lots of space for people to stand just before it.
Right.
So what happened here, the cars would come out of a small bend.
Right.
And hit that very long, fast pit straight.
Yeah.
And as they're coming out of that small bend, you got people at the side of the racetrack watching it. And then that leads into a massive grandstand.
Oh, okay.
So loads and loads of people. Mm. To rub salt into the wounds of what was to happen that day, 1955 was the largest crowd ever seen at Le Mans up to that moment.
Oh, got it.
About 300,000 people.
So it's rammed.
Absolutely
rammed.
Rammed.
So the race gets underway.
Starters' orders.
Starters' orders. They're all stood on the curb. and then they have to run to their cars, get in their cars.
That is genius.
But they're saving a lot of time because they haven't got to put helmets on or seatbelts. All that's out of the way. Okay. And they all start driving.
Yay.
They're driving. Sometimes Mercedes-Benz is in the lead. Sometimes Jaguar's in the lead. Sometimes Mercedes-Benz is in the lead. One kidney, nothing to lose. Mike Hawthorne, with a beauty on his arm, he was hammering it around Les Mens. Mm. Right, he's driving like a public school nutter in a BMW up the M40 at 3 o'clock in the morning. Right, coked up to the tits, probably. Can you libel the dead? No, coked up to the tits, Mike Hawthorne. He's driving. I've heard people say that he was driving like it was a sprint, like it wasn't a 24-hour race, like he was just fucking hammering it.
Mm. He constantly kept breaking the course record, didn't he? Lap after lap.
And they were trying to blow up the Mercedes car, weren't they? Wasn't that their idea?
Yes. They realised that driver-wise, they probably didn't have enough balance to beat...
They couldn't beat Fangio.
Couldn't beat Fangio. Yeah. So Jaguar tactic was, what we'll do is we will just rag our Jaguars so fast round that at some point the Mercedes will try and keep up, but they won't be able to because we're going so stupidly fast that they'll just break down and all go
wrong. Blow up. Now, we mentioned that other driver earlier. Do you remember that film?
Pierre Levay.
Even though he was in a Mercedes, he wasn't the lead Mercedes car that Jaguar were worrying about. They were worried about Fangio.
Juan Fangio.
Levay was well out of it in terms of being near the lead at any point, right? He's kind of like a backup driver for Mercedes. Mm. Really, they're putting all of their eggs into...
Juan Fangio.
Juan Fangio. In fact, 2.5 hours into the race and on lap 35, Hawthorne, Maverick Hawthorne, driving his Jaguar like a frickin' thing possessed, he'd lapped the Frenchman. He's gone round the track one more time than Levay. So they're sort of neck and neck, but obviously a lap behind.
But a lap behind.
Okay. Yeah. And where was he about to do that, Phil? Where was he about to lap Levay?
A rough guess would be just coming out of the bend that leads into the pit straight where lots of people are standing on the sidelines and the big grandstand is.
Absolutely. And because it's Le Mans and they're mad, the pit stop doesn't have like a separate road, does it? It's on the road.
That's mad, isn't
it? It's literally like a lay-by.
You've got a road here. This bit of track is about three cars wide, isn't it? And if you decide to stop in the pits, that makes that track two cars wide.
They literally just stop on the road.
Incredible.
Absolute madness.
It's the 50s, though.
Okay, so three-lane road. One of them, it becomes the pit stop, and you've got a massive grandstand filled with people. Mm. They're all watching the race and all bored. At this point, the cars, all of these cars, are going anywhere from 120 to 150 miles an hour.
But you feel it in the cars like that.
You've got Hawthorne in front, razzing the tits off his Jaguar. Mm. Fangio in second.
Not very far behind.
In his Merc. Mm. Levay is a lap behind, but he's on the same bit of track as they are.
Yeah, he's with them, isn't he?
He's with them. And a little diddy little Austin Healey, driven by a chap called Lance Macklin.
Very tiny little cars, Austin Healey's.
So what's he doing, like 50?
Loads of different manufacturers entered Le Mans.
Yeah.
So you had these massive super rivalries, but also you had lesser companies. Now, Austin Healey's not a small car. It is a little sports car.
Oh, okay.
But it's prestige, isn't it?
Oh, okay.
It's a road car, the Austin Healey. You could have sold your little
it does seem mad, doesn't it?
It does seem mad. But East Tonga, I mean, they're not slow, but they're not in the league of the sort of blue and silver bastard cars of Mike Hawthorne. But, you know, yes, you've got this chap, Lance Macklin, East Tonking along.
Yeah.
In his little Austin Healey, and he's getting lapped as well, I believe, isn't
he? Yeah, so like LeVay, he's well out of the race. Mm. They're being left in the tracks of these two maniacs, right, who are pissing it around this track because there's no future for them, right? Now, all of these cars were all bunched up together because this stretch of the track could only accommodate three cars side by side. So it's a little bottleneck.
Mm.
There was a man in the crowd at this point who takes up the story. Phil?
The Mercedes and the Jaguar were battling it out. We were leaning forward to see which car was winning, and then I saw a white underbelly flying upwards. I remember the car high, high in the air, as high as the top of an electric pole. My wife and I were terrified. We just froze. We didn't know what happened exactly. I pulled my wife down to the ground so all the pieces of the car just went over the top of us. If I hadn't done that, we wouldn't be here today. All right, well, let's rewind a few seconds from that chap's account.
Okay.
Hawthorne was hurtling along,
yeah,
but he had to make a pit stop.
Mm.
And remember, we're coming into the pit straight at this moment.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's coming out of the bend onto the pit straight when he whizzes past old Lance Macklin in his little Austin Healey.
Tootling along.
In fact, Macklin actually just let him pass, so because he knew there's no, what's the point?
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
At this moment, Hawthorne, now in front of Macklin, brakes to slow down for the pits.
Yeah.
Taken by surprise, Macklin swerves to his left to avoid going straight into the back of Mad Mike Hawthorne's Jag. But by doing that, what Macklin has done is he's put his car directly in the path of Pierre LeVay, the French guy, in the other Merc.
If it was a motorway in the middle lane. Mm. He's like swerved into the middle lane.
Now, LeVay had no time to swerve out of the way. His car hit the back of Macklin's Austin Healey and literally drove up the side of it like it was a ramp. This launched it into the air and towards the crowd, who were packed alongside the track and the main grandstand. So that is the point where you hear the spectator we spoke about said that he suddenly saw this white underbelly hurtling towards him. Now, at this point of the sight, there is just a chest-high Wattle and Earth barrier between these supercars and the spectators.
Wow.
Now, Wattle and Earth is like Wattle and Daub, isn't it?
Yeah, mud.
Mud. It's just a mud barrier.
Yeah.
Any car out of control at this point had nowhere to go but straight into the crowd. LeVay's car skipped over that Wattle and Earthen barrier at about 125 miles an hour.
Oh, shit.
Where it cartwheeled in and along the spectator area for 80 metres.
So like a rotor, like a rotary blade going through the crowd. Mm. Yeah, Jesus.
LeVay was thrown out of this cartwheeling car where he smacked onto the ground,
crushing
his skull and dying in an instant.
Ah, Jesus.
As if that wasn't bad enough, the car then hit a concrete stairwell and totally disintegrated.
Yeah.
The momentum of that disintegration sent the heaviest components of the car, things like the engine, the radiator, the front suspension, straight into the crowd for almost 100 metres, crushing everyone in their paths.
Like a huge shell, like a gigantic battleship shell that's gone through into that crowd, isn't it?
It's in split seconds. Yeah. It's absolute, it's unbelievable. There's a journalist, right, a French guy at the time, and he talked about the bonnet of the car.
Yeah.
And he said that that bonnet sighed through the air, decapitating tightly jammed spectators like a guillotine.
Jesus Christ. That's fucking awful.
That is horrendous.
That's fucking terrible, man.
Another spectator said that people were cut in two pieces.
Jesus.
You look down on the ground and you see a guy lying on the ground with binoculars around his neck, but his head is gone.
Christ almighty. That's mad, isn't it?
A lot of the deaths in this tragedy were decapitations.
That's really horrible.
So that's not good, is it?
No.
Right? Then what remained of the car exploded and rained down flaming debris on top of the scene that was already going on.
Didn't it have like mercury in it or something?
Yeah, because it's alloy. It was an unusual alloy. So it's poisonous
flaming mercury flying onto the crowd.
Which is highly flammable and would take a lot longer to put out than just...
than normal fire.
Yeah. Another survivor commented, the car caught fire and exploded about 3 metres from us. We were right up against the fence.
Yeah.
The people behind us had climbed onto trestle tables and they just got their heads cut off. I saw a child's head cut off.
You never get over that. That's awful, isn't it? So, we've said a lot about what happened, but let's get some bullet points, Phil. Let's try and put this to some time of horrific order.
Yes, because we said a lot. Right, so okay. The car's launched into the air,
yep,
over the barrier, cartwheeled along a spectator area for almost 80 metres.
Yeah.
It then smashes into concrete, causing the car to send large pieces of debris flying into the main grandstand crowd.
Yeah.
What's left of the car then catches fire and rains burning debris down on that scene.
So under these circumstances, Phil, which you set out so deftly, what do you think the organisers did?
I would imagine probably just... they would have...
They carried on with the race!
Whoa!
This is weird, isn't it? That they just carried on racing? Hawthorne did another lap.
Of course he did.
To be fair to him, when he did eventually come into the pits, he was, by all accounts, pretty screwed in the head. I think he knew what he'd done and he knew what had happened. He was apparently in tears.
Yeah, wasn't he? He was like crying and just telling everyone, it was my fault. I've caused this. This is awful.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think he took a lot of that blame on sort of immediately. Mm. But the race just carried on. What you therefore had for the next few hours was cars racing through like a disaster site.
That's incredible.
Just past the debris and the bodies just racing past it.
So they're whacking through.
Yeah.
And as they're driving through, they're seeing stretchers carrying away bodies from an accident that was caused by the race that they're in.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. I know it's the 1950s,
but
I mean, there's a point.
Have a heart. Have some decorum, lads.
Oh, my God.
But, Phil, you have to remember, as you said, this is the 50s.
Yeah.
Right? And the death of 83 people, most of them decapitated, like we said, isn't going to make snowflakes of the race organisers.
Harder times.
It's harder times, Phil. They're going to keep on racing. It's the Les Mens. They've been looking forward to this. Yeah. All year have been looking forward to going to Les Mens.
It's not strictly fair to say that.
Oh, okay.
Because it's easy to see the race continuing as a heartless move by the organisers.
It is easy to see that. I think you're going to have to give me a fairly freaking good reason why they had to carry on racing.
Well, it is still controversial. But at that time of this disaster, what the officials didn't want was to stop the race for fear that all those 300,000 spectators would leave en masse and block all the roads that the emergency vehicles were trying to get up to get in to the event.
All right, fair enough.
So they kind of figured the less people... Because don't forget, 300,000 weren't all at that point. They were all around. And they thought the less people that knew,
that's true,
the less panic.
Because they don't give a fuck, do they? They're just like, oh, something's happened. They've cancelled the race.
Mm.
And I'll go home.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then ambulances aren't getting through. More people die.
So there was that, you know, carry on with the race. Less people will leave. Emergency vehicles.
What would you do?
Well, you're not just dealing with the dead, are you?
You've got
about 200 people who are seriously, seriously injured. Then there is the fact that you can't carry on racing.
There must be a third way here.
Can you stop the race but tell people to not leave?
Yeah.
Just go, we're going to temporarily stop it, guys.
Or do that thing. They do it now and then they have a car that drives slow. And
the pace car or whatever. Yeah, safety car.
A safety car.
Yeah, which is ironically a Mercedes-Benz always.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Okay. But the race went on, Phil.
8 hours.
It went on for 8 hours. They just fucking finished the race.
Amazing.
Oh, man alive. This is the generation that are currently booting our country out of the European Union, God bless them. Okay. So 8 hours after the incident.
A full working day.
A full working
Imagine
day.
Imagine how long it is. You go into the office at 9, you're getting home, you've had a shite day at work, you're knackered, you feel like the world's gone on forever. That's how long after this disaster they are racing past that disaster.
It's long enough for you to be pretty badly wounded, get put in an ambulance, get taken to the hospital, have had an operation and be recovering and go, how's the race going? And they go, oh, well, Hawthorne's still in the lead. For fuck's sake! Fuck's sake! 8 hours, the race is still going on, right? It was at this point that Mercedes, the Germans, Phil, do you remember them?
The Bosch.
The Germans.
The Germans.
The pesky Germans, they decided to pull out of the race. After 8 hours, it occurred to them that it might look bad. That it might be a bit of a PR disaster to be racing over the blood.
From something that one of their cars,
exactly,
not their fault, but one of their cars had caused.
And so they said to Jaguar, this bit's bad. They said to Jaguar, look, guys, we're going to pull out of the race, okay, because there's a lot of people dead. And what did Jaguar do? They went, fucking brilliant, we're going to win this easy. We'll win it easy!
Oh, I don't know if I want a Jag now.
And so, yeah, Mercedes pulled out and Jaguar said no, and Jaguar carried on racing. And because Jaguar carried on racing, who won? Bloody Hawthorne.
Mad Hawthorne, the gay cavalier of motor racing.
Captain One Kidney pissed it past.
That is controversial.
He won the tits off it, even with tears in his eyes. Right? I don't know how I feel about it, but it didn't go down massively well, as you can imagine.
No, I mean, they did the normal sort of shaking up the champagne thing at the end of the race.
Yep.
Smiles all round, yep. You know, Hawthorne. Doing what motor racing drivers do when they win.
I mean, I can't believe they did the shaking the champagne. Even if you decided to carry on the race, even if you won it,
yeah,
then you would be like, this is a time for reflection.
Yeah, I mean, I think, to be slightly fair, I think they didn't decide to go ahead with the full regalia of the win, but it was kind of like an impromptu one. But it still became a champagne, swigging, champagne spurting, smiling thing. And there's plenty of pictures of Hawthorne smiling, drinking
Whereas
champagne.
It feels to me like it should have been a press conference.
Oh, my God.
It should have been him sat behind a desk going, yes, this Le Mans has finished.
Get out the car, totally solemn.
Yes, exactly. We've done this one. We finished the race, you know, because we respect Le Mans or some of the bollocks their PR company could have put
together.
Yeah,
it's what they would have wanted. Yeah, their races, it's in their blood. They would have wanted us to carry on.
Exactly.
But then saying that, I'm not sure about the 83 people.
No, exactly.
But
there would have been some bollocks they could have said.
Yeah.
Not like, hey, yeah. Sorry, what? Yeah, never mind. Hey! It's...
Yeah, yeah. Well, the French magazine, Le Auto Journal.
The car magazine.
The Journal of Cars. They published a photo of a smiling Mike Hawthorne swigging from a bottle of champagne.
Doesn't look good.
And I love this. It's very sarcastic. And the caption said, "To your health, Mr. Hawthorne."
Yeah, that's very French,
isn't
it?
That's quite brutal, isn't
Burf.
It? Yeah. Phil, talk about the aftermath.
Inevitably, Phil. Blame and accusations.
We love them as a race.
There was claims and counterclaims. Mercedes blamed Jaguar.
Yeah.
They think it is the English. Jaguar, you never guess who they blamed.
Did they blame Mercedes?
Blame Mercedes.
I think it's the bloody Bosch.
A lot of people, without any iron in the fire, blamed Lance Macklin and his little Austin Healey.
Oh, the really slow guy, yeah.
Seems a bit out of order, because it seems to me like that guy just reacted.
Didn't look in his mirrors.
Yes, but he is not the architect of that, is he? He's he's reacting. Mm. Some people blamed old Pierre Levay for not reacting quick enough.
It's a bit
old.
Brutal.
I think it's a bit brutal. And also he's dead, so you can't sort of give his point of view.
Yeah.
Which I think that's a bit out of this one. But to this day, Phil, people are still arguing about it.
Yes. When we were doing the research, there's still sort of old racing drivers, actually racing drivers who are driving that day.
Yeah.
And they're all
different ideas about whose fault it was.
Yeah.
Hawthorne, Maverick Hawthorne, after sobbing in the pits directly after the crash, appeared in public a few days later and protested his innocence. So, almost like they got at him. Like to say,
like Jaguar have said.
Yeah, like your insurance company. Don't say it was your fault right from the start, mate. We'll find out what happened and then maybe we can see where we stand. So he sort of rode back on that quite quickly. But a subsequent public inquiry, Phil, do you like an inquiry?
They make the public happy, but what do they really sort?
Well, the thing I like about it is this goes along the lines of every public inquiry we've ever talked about on this on this podcast. Public inquiry, guess what it did?
Absolved everyone.
Absolved all the drivers of blame. They should call these public inquiries public absolving committees. We absolve everybody of blame. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Very odd, though.
Very good. Yes, the inquiry did, however, blame the death of the spectators on inadequate safety standards in the track design.
Oh, so it did do something.
This seems fair enough, right? Have a barrier. Wear an helmet. Yeah. Have a seatbelt.
Don't base your crash protection on Iron Age dwellings.
Exactly.
Wattle and daub.
Have the pits be in a pit, not on the track. I mean, don't put the pits on the track. It just seems insane. It's like the services isn't in the middle of the motorway. You don't drive directly into common services.
It's almost like getting rid of the hard shoulder.
Yeah, it's fucking madness, right? The thing about the Les Mennes circuit is that it was largely unaltered since 1923,
yes,
when top speeds were 15 miles an hour and men still walked in front of the car with a little red flag, and people thought that if you went faster than 30, your soul was left behind, right? They're old tracks designed for old cars. When people were going around Les Mennes in the 1920s, they were going at around about 60 miles an hour.
Okay.
The speed that my dad drives on the M40. By 1955, top speeds were around 170 miles an hour.
Yeah, it's a lot more.
It's a lot more. Mm. Now, the circuit had been resurfaced and widened post-war.
Right.
But the cars had simply, they'd outgrown the circuit. It's an arms race, isn't it? The cars are getting better. They're battling out, so the track has to keep up with the cars, and it wasn't doing that.
It's a bit kind of like Monaco in a way.
Is it?
Monaco is still, it's a road race, it's a very old track, and it's, I mean, obviously there's loads of safety stuff in Monaco, but
there's only so much you can,
it's a
so
ludicrous sight for,
yeah, just stop doing it.
Yeah.
Stop doing it. But what they've done, instead of stopping it and trying something else, is they've gone down the let's carry on doing it, but make it extremely boring. That's what they've done. It's clever, really. Really clever what they've done with motor racing.
Yeah, what we'll do is have no overtaking possibilities whatsoever for 2 hours in this race.
Yeah. That's right. Okay. So it had been resurfaced and it had been widened, but the cars had just outgrown the circuit. And the ways and spectators were still far too close to the cars and largely unprotected.
I don't think they'd really thought about it, had they?
Everyone's unprotected.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's stupid.
I mean, it's just like, oh, if a car crashes, it'll hit this Watland door barrier. Everything will be all right.
They were kind of, well, it's part of the sport, weren't they? People just die in motor racing.
Mm.
It seemed to me like that was very much their idea. It was like, yes, motor racing, yeah, well, I know 25% of a man is going to die every year. That's motor racing. Mm. You know what I mean? But after this, people thought maybe we should try and do something.
Well, exactly, yeah. A few things did actually happen. There was an immediate temporary ban on all motorsport in many countries until the sort of racetracks could be made safer and they could do inquiries.
They banned it everywhere.
Virtually everywhere. All the main sort of, what I'd call the main countries. the good countries.
The important countries banned it.
Switzerland, to this day, still has a motor racing ban stemming from Le Mans.
Does it really?
Yeah. It does have a slight tweak in the law. It allows it to have a few electric vehicles tonking around here.
I bet that's exciting.
Yeah, great.
electric car racing in Switzerland. Can you imagine? Oh, be still my beating heart.
Yeah, so Switzerland, still after Le Mans, still no motor racing. Mercedes-Benz, they pulled out of motorsport completely for over 30 years after Le Mans.
Wow,
just like,
Jesus.
No, we don't want anything more to do with this.
Respect.
Even Jaguar,
really,
you know, carried on with the race.
Yeah.
That racing team was disbanded a few months after the tragedy. And Jaguar itself didn't return to Le Mans for over 30 years.
Oh, okay. This is all good. This is like respect, isn't it?
In terms of physical stuff, the audience grandstand at Le Mans was completely demolished and rebuilt with a big wide ditch between
sensible.
The spectators and the racetrack. Yeah. And that little curve just before the pit straight, they got rid of that.
Yeah.
So you didn't have that kind of bunching up and that slight
bottleneck.
But to this day, there's still no memorial to any of the victims of this. And to my knowledge, I think there's only ever been one memorial service, which was on the 60th anniversary of it.
Why wouldn't they have a memorial?
You'd think something, sort of. Or even in the town of Le Mans.
Yeah.
A sort of...
A little statue or
statue
something.
Statue of a... Well, they normally have like a mother holding a kid or something.
It's usually a mother holding a kid, isn't it?
In this case... In this case, they might have something more artistic.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Tie with a flower coming out of it. I don't know, something. But no, something, maybe just a slab with some nice words.
Just something to commemorate the fact that over 80 people got hideously murdered by essentially a game.
It really is horrible. It was horrible just researching it, seeing the photographs that you didn't want to see.
Horrible. I tell you what, I'm never going to go and watch motor racing.
Because it's dangerous.
No, it's boring. It's really boring, that's why.
What happened to the main drivers that we've been mentioning throughout all of this podcast, Phil?
Juan Fangio.
Juan Fangio.
The greatest racing driver of all time. Mm. He drove through and past the accident.
So he was never really involved, was he?
He was in that major bottleneck, but he was away.
Yeah.
He never entered Le Mans again.
Ah, so it affected him in that sense.
Fangio never went back. He continued motor racing, though, because he was too fucking good at motor racing not to continue motor racing. Plus, what's he going to do for a living? Drive a taxi? He'd won enough, though, to go down in history as the greatest driver of all time. He'd won it all, mate, Fangio. He died in 1995, age 84. He had a good long life, Fangio. Lance Macklin, in his little Austin Healey, actually walked out of his car that day and survived the tragedy.
Wow.
Nothing happened to Macklin. Not long after, at another event, though, he was involved in a crash that killed two other drivers. Mm. Racing cars is dangerous. Should stop doing it.
He sounds like a bit of a jinx. I don't want to be unfair,
His girlfriend urged Macklin to quit motorsport, and he duly retired.
I think he's causing
crashes. Yeah. In his later life, he worked in a car dealership in London.
Oh, great salesman.
You heard of London?
He
died in 2002, aged 82.
Oh, it's really good innings.
Another good innings.
Unlike everyone he knew.
Exactly. That's right. Everyone in his rearview mirror. A rather grotesque sideline to this, though, is that the damaged car that Macklin was driving that day went on to be sold via auction a number of times. People bought that car. Ugh. Do you know how much it went for the last time it was auctioned in 2011?
200 grand.
£843,000.
That's so...
Why would you want that? That's... Where would you put it? It's not pretty. I mean, I suppose in a museum would have it, maybe, but why would a private buyer buy that?
It's grotesque.
Yeah.
It's the car that sort of...
That possibly
was the chain reaction of something really horrendous.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, this is the car that won the...
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think there's something weird about... But then again, you and I like dark tourism. Maybe there's,
well, that's
maybe
true.
There's dark motor racing
do you reckon there is?
Memorabilia collectors.
I bet there is.
I bet there is, yeah.
Macklin himself, he always considered Mike Hawthorne a friend.
Okay.
Remember Mike Hawthorne?
Yeah, Mad Mike Hawthorne, the gay cavalier of motor racing.
He considered him a friend.
Okay.
But when Hawthorne's autobiography came out in 1958, he absolved himself of all blame for the crash, but failed to say who he thought had been responsible. And Macklin thought, well, if he's not saying who he thought's responsible, he reckons it's me.
Oh.
And so he sued the tits off him.
Oh, even in those days.
Yep, sued him. The libel suit didn't get very far, though, unfortunately. Well, no, unfortunately, it didn't get very far because Hawthorne himself was dead not long after... This libel case was issued. Now then, Hawthorne, one kidney, 3 years to live, racing driver, opening himself up to an ironic death. Mm-hmm. How do you think Hawthorne died?
I'd like to say motor racing, but it's not going to be, is it?
It is.
Oh.
He was racing on the A3 bypass near Guildford.
Whoa, whoa, that's a public road.
It is indeed.
That's not motor racing. That's illegally driving silly.
Ironically, he was racing his friend who was driving a Mercedes next
to him.
I tell you, opening himself up to an ironic death. Terrible.
That's full on irony.
So, Phil, that was the truly fucking horrible, actually, Les Mans disaster.
Gross.
1955, I thought, or God's fault?
I don't know, Phil. In all honesty, could have been Hawthorne's fault.
Yeah.
Could have been Macklin's fault.
Yeah.
Could have been the design of the circuit's fault.
Yeah.
What we do know is that Hawthorne, Macklin, and all the people who designed that racing circuit were all human beings.
Yes.
So it's our fault.
Oh, it's definitely our fault.
That's motor racing, folks.
So, Phil, got any admin you want to get across?
I have, actually. I would like to give a massive thank you to Paul and Rebecca Whitewick. I don't know if any of you see.
Oh, yeah, who interviewed you on your train.
Yes, they're a lovely, lovely couple.
Lovely couple.
Rebecca from Andover. Lovely couple. And they came and visited me in my other life of driving a little train up and down.
Yeah.
And we spoke about the train and we spoke about this podcast. And
they were super nice about the podcast.
They were really nice. We're so, so grateful that they said such nice things. Really touching. They are great. They do this amazing project where they want to visit every disused station
really?
In the UK. There's over 2,000 of them.
Oh, Christ.
This project
really?
Is going to take
Yeah, years.
Years and years and years. Now, Paul and Rebecca have got five children.
Right.
And five children is five children too many. But they are still cracking on with this. And they put videos out every time they visit. They go out virtually every weekend.
Do the kids go with them?
Sometimes they do, yeah. And great little videos, really interesting. If you're into that sort of thing, do check out Paul and Rebecca's stuff. On Facebook, they're under Every Disused Station.
That's wicked.
YouTube, White Wycks Abandoned Railways, type in, and you'll come up. On Twitter, you could look for Paul or Rebecca. You've got at Paul White Wyck, or use the hashtag Every Disused Station, and you'll see all of Paul and Rebecca's stuff. They're so nice, and we are so grateful for that little video and all the lovely things they said. So thank you, Paul and Rebecca. And also, that led to a very nice review on the old iTunes.
We've had a couple of nice reviews, haven't we?
We have, yes.
Chris Zampf.
Okay.
Chris Zampf.
Thank you,
Five
Chris.
Stars. Because of Phil's interview with the White Wycks.
Oh.
Just consumed three episodes in a row.
Three in a row.
I like the word consumed.
Consumed. That's what you do, yes. Sort of into your veins.
An informative yet funny look at disasters without being mawkish or rubbernecking with two friends who riff well off each other. I think he's over-egging our relationship there.
But thank you very much.
And we also had a review from Grant Waite.
Okay.
Grant Waite. Late to the party, he says. I don't think he is late to the party.
Oh.
Also, it doesn't feel like a party, does it? Light-hearted awesome. Approach to depressing situations.
Thank it's you how so I used much. To try and live my life.
It's pretty much our life, isn't it? Thank you so much for giving us a view. If you wanted to give us a review, you're more than welcome. That would really help us out. Our listening figures are going up and up every episode that we put out. We're really pleased that people are starting to listen more and more.
Yes, and a lot of that is very much down to people telling other people about it or being nice, sharing
and
reviews.
It's
very kind
of
them.
So yes, if you know somebody who would like this podcast, please do point them in the right direction towards it. It would be lovely if you gave us a review. We're on Twitter. We're on the other social platforms as well. But contact us on Twitter if you fancy talking to us, having a go at us, giving us suggestions. We're working through the suggestions, aren't we? What are we doing next week?
I'd like to do the Moorgate Tube disaster.
Okie doke.
Because last week I was very fortunate enough to have a ride in a tube train cab.
Cool.
And of course, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And then thought, there's a tube disaster we could write about.
Sounds perfect. Let's do the tube.
Okay.
Lovely. Thank you so much for listening to the Crash Bang Wallop podcast this week. Phil Lucas, got anything to add?
No.
How were your ears?
They're good now. Now I've had the microsuction by a posh lady.
Brilliant. You got anything else to add?
No.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
I can hear the birds.
He can hear the birds, ladies and gentlemen. He can live his life. Thank you so much for listening to the Crash Band Wallet podcast. We will see you in 2 weeks' time. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.